see. And we also know that this is how Allah sometimes answers things. He will send us the words, the things we need to hear via other sources. So that's advising the good. So anything good we know or we find, let's share it, let's help everyone. When it comes to obviously prohibiting the bad, now this is obviously this is trickier, and I just remind people this is something we also need to be engaged in, but it also means that we have the knowledge that there is a bad thing to do. We need to be able to say to ourselves, okay, I know that this is not something good. And then we also need to know that if we speak to this person, there's a likelihood they will even listen to us. And then we need to be able to do it in a way that is actually useful for them. So it's not humiliating. We're not pointing something out in public where they're sort of other people are listening in. So it has various conditions. But inshallah, think about that too. And I pray that you gain some reminders from today and look forward to welcoming you to another episode of A to Z here on Arab English Radio with me, Sister Zainab, and farewell for now. Thank you very much for listening to this episode of A to Z. And for more information, please also visit our website at www.iranradio.ir.
The sovereignty of a nation versus the power of the U.S. military. That is the situation that Venezuela finds itself in. The country with the richest and vast amount of natural resources like oil, gas, gold, and lithium is being targeted by the U.S., a regime change operation that has many goals in mind by removing the democratically elected president. The U.S. excuse that it is targeting drug cartels in Venezuela is not believed by anyone. What the U.S. wants from Venezuela is the removal of Maduro from power and to ultimately flood the market with Venezuelan oil and gas in order to decrease income from some of its enemies. Hi, I'm Karash Purnamati. This is The Economic Divide. Coming up in today's program, our first headline, the U.S. wants regime change in Venezuela, and it's doing that through first a massive military buildup, hoping Maduro will cede power on his own. This would be another U.S. regime change scenario in Latin America. It's common knowledge that the U.S. wants Venezuela's riches like oil and gas. But what the U.S. doesn't want the world to know is how this could potentially achieve multiple U.S. goals impacting its adversaries. U.S. sanctions on Venezuela. The U.S. has sanctioned Venezuela for much of this past decade, hoping that crippling its economy would instigate a popular uprising. But that has failed to materialize since Venezuelans have substantially overcome some of these illegal sanctions. We're going to be discussing those points and a whole lot more with Professor Peter Kuznick, director of the Nuclear Studies Institute at American University, and also Raman Grossvogel, professor at the University of California at Berkeley, specializing in decolonial studies and political economy of the world system.
Thank you for having me on the show. The excuse that Trump and members of his administration are giving is that Venezuela is in part responsible for the drugs that are flowing into the United States, and that therefore Maduro is a narco-terrorist, and the United States, in order to protect its own national security, is destroying the boats that are carrying the drugs. This is a lie. It's total fabrication. What Trump says we're going after, the U.S. going after, is the fentanyl. Venezuela is not involved in transiting, manufacturing, producing, shipping fentanyl. The U.S. military told members of Congress that the drugs that are on some of these boats are cocaine, not fentanyl. Fentanyl is produced mostly in Mexico. So, number one, that's a lie. Number two, you don't send this vast armada and all these troops, 15,000 troops, to Venezuela, off the coast of Venezuela, to interdict drug boats. So the U.S. wants to invade Venezuela, partly because Venezuela has vast oil reserves. Some say the biggest oil reserves in the world. So that's what Trump is after. And if the U.S. is able to overthrow Maduro and take control of those oil reserves, that would have great impact not only on the world economy, but on global geopolitics.
Venezuela has suffered extreme hardship under illegal U.S. sanctions. An economic embargo has blocked Venezuela from accessing the U.S.-dominated international financial system and prevented Venezuela from exporting its oil and fixing or updating its oil infrastructure, causing government revenue to shrink by a staggering 99%, according to the top U.N. expert on sanctions, the special rapporteur Elena Duhani. However, Venezuela's economy today is in a much better state than it was previously during the previous U.S.-led attempt coup back in 2019 to 2020, which caused hyperinflation. The inflation rate has fallen a lot. Real wages have risen. Food and everyday necessities are affordable right now. The economy has dollarized a lot, however, which erodes the monetary sovereignty of the Venezuelan government.
The U.S. has a number of things in mind. Number one, it wants to seize Venezuela's oil and then flood the market with oil, which would lower the price of oil and therefore have a devastating impact, the U.S. figures, on Russia's economy, on Iran's economy. But also, this is the U.S. way to overthrow the government in Cuba. Cuba is dependent on inexpensive oil from Venezuela. The Cuban economy which is shaky already, would be sunk by cutting off that oil from Venezuela. The U.S. biggest prize in Latin America is, and it's not exactly Latin America, but South America, would be Brazil.
Welcome back. This is the social section of the program. The first item that we are covering for you is, can you imagine what would happen to oil exports if the U.S. really achieved a regime change in Venezuela? No wonder that Russia is so nervous about what's happening there. As the U.S. renews its threats against Venezuela, authorizes a CIA operation, and mobilizes regime change rhetoric, the country is still being denied access to its own gold reserves. $1.8 billion frozen in the Bank of England. It's not about democracy. It's about control of Venezuela's old gold and lithium and punishing nations that resist the empire. The Cartel of the Suns was literally created by the CIA, also known as the Cocaine Import Agency. Max Blumenthal methodically exposes the WMD-level lies justifying U.S. attacks on Venezuela and explain the devastating consequences of a regime change war.
The big lie of this war is the Cartel of the Suns. As Ryan said, the Cartel of the Suns was literally created by the CIA, also known as the Cocaine Import Agency, to ship 22 tons of drugs into the United States in the early 90s through its main point of contact in the pre-Chavez Venezuelan National Guard, General Ramon Guillen.
Former U.S. Ambassador James Story. Maduro is sitting on top of the world's largest oil reserves, minerals that will fuel the 21st century economy, and he's in bed with our strategic competitors. It isn't about narco-trafficking, it certainly is not about democracy. It's about Monroe doctoring imperial domination to steal Venezuela's resources for U.S. corporations.
Thank you.
U.S. is in a big crisis. I would say that the U.S. empire is in a terminal crisis. They have lost the commercial wars with China in Africa and Asia. The last remaining space that they have at hand to keep their status as empire is Latin America. But however, in Latin America, there's still a strong presence of China in the markets and of sovereign countries that are challenging U.S. empire in the region. Venezuela is one of the richest countries in the world. It has the largest oil fields in the world. It has one of the countries with the large resources in gas. It's one of the countries with the largest resources in gold mines, in water, in minerals that are important for artificial intelligence, computers, and military industry. So it's a very wealthy country in terms of resources. And so what the U.S. is trying to do is to recover those resources as a way to recover its, come out of its own crisis. Remember, USA has a debt that is in the trillions. It's around $30 trillion with the letter T. And they need to, in a sense, do something dramatic in order to recover those resources from a rich country such as Venezuela, because the Bolivarian government has, in a sense, kept sovereignty over its economy and over its natural resources.
One similarity between Venezuela and Syria was the economic warfare waged against them by the West. The Syrian government fell in part because the US-EU Caesar sanctions had devastated the economy. Syria could not get access to hard currency and thus had very high inflation. The major difference, the Western-sponsored war on Syria, which began in 2011, the Syrian state was significantly weakened by more than a decade of war.
The U.S. has a reserve of oil in their own country for another 6 to 7 years. U.S. is now having a situation where in the very short term, they're going to have scarcity of oil. Right now, they don't have any other sources of oil like they used to have in the past, except purchasing the oil at the international markets the way they are cost today. And what they're trying to do in recovering the oil fields of Venezuela, which by the way have the largest oil reserve in the world, okay? Venezuela is the country with the largest oil reserve in the world. What they're trying to do is to have access to oil resources at a cheaper price.
Welcome back. This is the InfoNews section of the program. The first item that we are covering for you is the U.S. hunger. Explainer, why millions sleep on an empty stomach in the U.S., the wealthiest country on earth? On October the 31st, former U.S. President Barack Obama highlighted an issue that is largely overlooked by legacy media but widely debated inside the country. More than 47 million Americans, including 1 in 5 children, don't have reliable, affordable access to nutritious food. And as the cost of living skyrockets, More families are depending on SNAP benefits or food stamps to put food on the table, he wrote in a post on X. The next item is the EU economy. EU blames economic woes on Donald Trump, but forgets who broke the machine. Brussels is preparing to cut growth forecasts for 2026, hinting already that Trump's tariffs and trade uncertainty are dragging Europe down. A neat explanation, especially for a crisis that the EU has spent years engineering with its own hands. The same EU that proudly cut itself off from cheap Russian energy. The next item is cashing in on the Gaza genocide. Gaza war bonanza. How U.S. giants cashed in big on Israel's genocide. Donald Trump is currently seeking congressional approval of a $6.4 billion package of U.S. weapons sales to Israel, including $3.8 billion in Boeing Apache attack helicopters and $1.9 billion for 3,200 to 3,250 infantry assault vehicles. West Coast giants like Microsoft, Google, and Amazon also signed deals to provide cloud computing, AI infrastructure, and data services to the Israeli military. Cloud deals can be worth tens of millions per year per contract. Our next item is oil sales to Israel. According to a report by Oil Change International, 25 countries were responsible for shipping vast amounts of oil to Israel during its two-year Gaza offensive. Azerbaijan, Kazakhstan, Russia, and the U.S. were among the largest suppliers of oil. More than 21 million tons of crude oil and refined fuels, including jet fuel used by military aircraft. Welcome back. This is the in-depth section of the program. The U.S. wants to eliminate the drug trafficking cartels in Venezuela, or at least that is the facade that the U.S. wants other nations to believe. The U.S., in fact, wants Nicolas Maduro gone. This reasoning is slammed internationally and also by the Latin American countries. Why, you ask? It's because they don't want the same fate happening to them. During the time that President Hugo Chavez was in charge of Venezuela, economically speaking, there were many strides made under his socialist system. Let's look at this graph, for example. The unemployment rate in 1999 was 14.5%. It almost halved to 7.6% in 2009. The next item is GDP per capita. In 1999, it was $4,105, while in 2011 it was $10,000, more than $10,000. The currency, let's look at this graph as well, and the inflation, the average consumer prices back in 1999 was 23.6%. In 2012, it was 31.6%. The next item that we are going to have is the extreme poverty rate. In 1999, it was 23.4%. But in 2011, it was 8.5% under Hugo Chavez. And the final one that we are going to have right here is oil exports, the nominal net rates. In 1999, it was $14.4 billion, while in 2011, $60 billion in revenue. The next item is a snapshot of the major sectors of the economy, which dates back to over a decade ago. It's interesting that oil exports back in 2008 were over $43 billion to have been reduced to $8.62 billion. The U.S. sanctions on the country were a major factor in low GDP per capita, of course, confidence in the government, and of course, inflation, which exploded to unprecedented levels, as you can see. Now, let's bring in our guest, Professor Peter Kuznick, director of the Nuclear Studies Institute at American University. Professor, is the U.S. flexing muscles against Venezuela to project power over Latin American countries, that if they don't follow the U.S. foreign policy here, they are going to suffer the same fate?
The U.S. is sending a message to all of Latin America, and as it's been sending to the rest of the world. When Trump talked at the beginning about invading Panama, invading Canada, invading Greenland, we saw who he is and what he represents. He said he wants the Nobel Peace Prize and deserves it. I'm the person who nominated last year's winner for the Nobel Peace Prize, the Japanese anti-nuclear group, survivor group, Nihon Nidankyo. I was part of their delegation in Oslo. The only prize that Trump deserves is the biggest warmonger, biggest fascist enabler on the planet right now.
Now, this graph right here shows the extent that the U.S. sanctions affected the Venezuelan economy. In 1999, $334 billion was the GDP of Venezuela, and during Maduro's time, it was reduced down to $68,216,000, a result of harsh U.S. sanctions, which cut off Venezuela from the world financial system. The next item looks at the year 2008. Things started to improve for Maduro and his government, and here are the improvements seen in different sectors as reflected in the GDP, which is a drastic improvement compared to figures just a couple of years ago. The economic indicators here shows the improvements. Notice GDP coming in at positive 3%, with inflation caught dramatically, quite an improvement from what it was previously. The economy's rebound was due to adjusting to sanctions, domestic production, and help from countries like Russia, Iran, and China. And repairing oil infrastructure allowed oil production to rise above 1 million barrels per day, bringing in more hard currency. One of the lesser known facts is that the U.S. has, throughout its history, attacked sovereign Latin American countries on many occasions, over 50 times, and wanting regime change or coups to lead to regime change. That is why many of the Latin American countries are against the U.S. warmongering policies, in this case, against Venezuela. Now let's bring in our other guest, Roman Grossvogel, professor at the University of California at Berkeley. Professor, can it be concluded that Donald Trump is after the oil and gas, not only for economic benefits for the U.S., but to be able to control the oil market against countries like in Latin America who are not subservient to the U.S. demands?
USA is trying to destroy the Bolivarian government, and they want to, which is right now the wall that is putting obstacles for the U.S. to have full control over the governments and the economy of the region. Right now, they are in an offensive to destroy all the governments that used to have some kind of sovereignty and claims against U.S. empire. For example, the Correa government in Ecuador was destroyed. The Kirchner's and Fernandez government in Argentina was destroyed. Now the Bolivia government was also, has been destroyed recently. And now the main country left right now with wealth resources is Venezuela.
As of November the 23rd, the U.S. has announced a new phase of military aggression against Venezuela, with so many U.S. officials saying that the U.S. is very much prepared for a new round of actions against Venezuela. By the time this program is aired, the U.S. may have launched an attack on Venezuela. The U.S. pressure to oust Maduro from power appears to be a definitive goal. Why would a military buildup in the Caribbean underway for months and Trump to have authorized covert CIA operations? It may be just a matter of time before there is an invasion or targeting of sites inside Venezuela. I'm Kyarash Bunamati, and I'll see you next week.
option for today and a better tomorrow. IRIB English Radio. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en.
Ask the followers of the remembrance if ye know not.
You are listening to the program The Key on Iran Radio with Sheikh Shiraz.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to our program The Key here at IRIB English Radio. Today on The Key, we're going to be examining a very significant question, and that question is related to one of the good deeds and one of the good acts. I'm speaking, of course, of memorizing the Quran. As you know, the Quran is the book of God, the book of Muslims that was revealed to the Holy Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa sallam. And from the beginning of Islam, one of the acts that Muslims used to do and still do is memorize the Quran. There's a lot of hadith which have been passed down to us from the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam regarding the virtue of memorizing the Quran. Let's look at some of these hadith before we get to our question. In one beautiful hadith, the Holy Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam said, "Whoever has been endowed by God with the memorization of his book and doubts that someone has been given something better than what he has despised the greatest bounty." This indicates the great virtue in memorizing the Quran. And conversely, it's been narrated that the Prophet said, "Someone who has none of the Quran in their self," meaning somebody who has not memorized any of the Quran, "is like a wrecked house," meaning it's like a house which is about to fall down and crumble upon itself. And the Prophet also said, "The bearers of the Quran," meaning those who memorize it, "are surrounded by the mercy of Allah and are dressed with the light of Allah." So nobody can doubt in the virtue of memorizing the Quran. The question we want to ask today is, what are some of the etiquettes of those who memorize the Quran? In order to answer this question, we can take recourse to some of the hadith which have been narrated regarding this subject. One of the etiquettes of memorizing the Quran is this. The Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam said, "The owner of the Quran," meaning the person who has memorized it, "should not be harsh towards those who are harsh with him." Meaning if somebody is harsh with this person, he's mean to him, he's not nice to him, this person who has memorized the Quran, he should act benevolently and kindly towards them. Then the Prophet said, "Nor behave ignorantly with those who are ignorant." If somebody acts ignorantly with him, unknowingly with him, this person should not respond in a similar way. And the Prophet also said, "Whilst he has the words of God inside of him." You should bear in mind that he has memorized the Quran and the meanings of the Quran are contained within him, right? So he shouldn't just memorize the Quran without acting upon its meanings, one of which is that we should act kindly to those who act unkindly towards us. In one hadith, the Prophet said, the noblemen of my community are the bearers of the Quran, meaning the people who memorize it, and the people of night vigil. Right? This kind of indicates that these two kind of go hand in hand, the memorization of the Quran and the night vigil, meaning performing acts of worship in the night. Finally, Imam Sadiq alayhi salam said, the memorizer of the Quran who acts according to it will be with the envoys, the noble, and the pious. Thank you for joining us here on The Key. We were looking at the etiquettes of memorizing the Quran in the light of the hadith of the infallible. Until next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
You just listened to the program The Key on Iran Radio with Sheikh Shiraz.
You can also send your questions to englishradio@irib.ir.
On September 22, 1980, when the Islamic Revolution of the Iranian people was not yet 2 years old, Saddam attacked Iran with the green light from the U.S. The former Iraqi dictator has signed a peace agreement with Mohammad Reza Pahlavi 5 years earlier, which had ended his border disputes with Iran. But just a few days before issuing the order to attack, much like the U.S. president who tore up the JCPOA agreement, he appeared openly and confidently on television and declared all his commitments with Iran null and void. Forty-five years later, with a 12-day imposed war, all these memories were revived for Iranians. This time, with America's green light, Benjamin Netanyahu, instead of Saddam, attacked Iran at a moment when indirect negotiations between Tehran and Washington were underway to supposedly resolve Iran's nuclear file peacefully. Now the entire world was waiting to see whether, just as Iranians under the guidance of their leader in the 8-year war with Saddam managed to force the enemy into accepting a ceasefire and defeat, in the second imposed war, the Israeli regime and its supporters would also be compelled to retreat or not. The Israeli regime's assessment was that, given Iran's chronic economic problems and social divisions, after a lightning military strike, spontaneous protest cells would emerge, and what happened in Syria would be repeated in Iran as well. Thus, it was that June 13th marked the beginning of a difficult time for Iranians. According to the planners of this attack, with the assassination of high-ranking generals, the situation in Iran would become so chaotic that higher groups and counter-revolutionaries could seize control of parts of Tehran, such as Mehrabad Airport and its surrounding areas, from the police and security forces. This was deemed to cause the conditions. Through street chaos, special forces would be airlifted into Iran, pushing the structure of Iran's government to the brink of collapse within a matter of days. The name of this operation had already been determined, True Promise 3. With operations True Promise 1 and 2, the IRGC in its first missile response did exactly what the regime had anticipated, using a large number of missiles so that the Israelis would feel assured that Iran's missile response pattern had not changed. The Israeli army assumed that by Iran's numerous launches, the locations of its missile systems would be exposed, and subsequently, under aerial strikes, another portion of the Islamic Republic's missile capability could be destroyed.
But we've not seen the pictures of it and been able to assess the nature of the damage because Israeli sensors have blocked that. But we also know that Iran hit and damaged, and in some cases destroyed, the Israel's version of the Pentagon, Israel's version of the CIA, Israel's version of the FBI, Israel's version of the National Security Agency. Israel has two seaports where containers come into the country and where exports leave the country. Iran shut those down. So wow. There was no more seatime, maritime traffic coming in and out of the port. Iran also destroyed the two oil refineries or interrupted their ability to process and produce fuel. The oil refineries at Haifa and Ashdod, which is also the places where the ports are located. Iran shut down the only international airport in Israel. So nobody was getting in and out of the country unless they went to a military airfield and got out on a military aircraft. But all of the military airfields in Israel were also hit.
I'm actually, it's more of a town, really, just on the outskirts of Tel Aviv, called Rishon LeZion. I am surrounded right now. If I look in every direction, there are a crew of about 12 emergency workers just in front of me now going patrolling houses everywhere around the streets here. There's the detritus of the strikes that happened at 5 a.m. this morning in this neighborhood. And just around the corner from me is the, well, what is now a crater, which used to be homes where two people died.
But that was not the whole story. Israel's costly and expensive attacks carried out with repeated NATO aircraft refueling in the skies not only wore down equipment, but also imposed numerous financial, security, and logistical constraints on Israel and its allies. For this reason, contrary to the bluffs of the Zionist officials, this war was supposed to end very quickly with a decisive victory. Yet Iran, by changing its defensive tactics, decided that, contrary to the enemy's design, the war should become long and attritional, so that Israel would be punished by accepting defeat and a ceasefire would be dictated to them.
Iran has stood up against it. Iran has the admiration and respect of the entire Arab world. The people in the Arab world that are not respected, that everybody loathes, are the ruling elites, because they are seen as eagerly selling everybody out for money and stability. So this war is going to continue for that reason. The other reason is that you can't leave Iran in place if you're an Israeli, because you've determined that they cannot be subjugated. If they can't be subjugated, if they won't submit to Israeli supremacy, inevitably they're going to come back and threaten Israel.
You get what Israel got, and basically, I don't know, they probably will not recover from this, at least in any time soon, if ever, actually. And you look attentively at some quarters of Tel Aviv or Beersheba, or it's just freaking like World War III there.
Iran's missile responses were so effective and unexpected that they quickly alarmed the West about Israel's imminent defeat.
Mouthies.
Thus, on the fourth and fifth days of the war, the leaders of the G7 gathered to take action in support of Israel. From that moment, it became clear that if the U.S. did not directly enter the field, Israel would be buried under the weight of Iran's missile strikes. For the White House, a strange situation arose. On the one hand, the fragile state of America's energy market, economy, and security was such that it could not enter into an intense war with Iran. On the other hand, it could not remain indifferent to the heavy blows that were pressuring its most important proxy force in the region. Therefore, in a historic gamble fraught with uncertainties, it decided to attack the nuclear facilities at Natanz, Fordo, and Isfahan. Immediately after this incident, Trump threatened Iran with consequences if it responded in any way and declared the time for a ceasefire and the end of the war had arrived.
And, you know, I listened to President Trump not too long ago say that Israel is winning. And, of course, this is the mantra in the mainstream media. But the question you have to ask yourself is, what does winning mean? It's a meaningless comment by itself.
If under these circumstances Iran had accepted a ceasefire, the United States would have succeeded in pulling Israel honorably out of the quagmire of war with Iran. But shortly after the U.S. Army's attack, Iran once again targeted Israeli-occupied territories with intense and devastating strikes. This time, the IRGC both changed its firing pattern and unleashed a large, energetic barrage upon Israel. Okay. releasing images of widespread destruction in occupied territories evoked Israeli army's assaults on Gaza. But the IRGC's missile campaign was not yet over. On the evening of June 23rd, the armed forces of the Islamic Republic carried out a precise attack named Bisharat al-Fath, glad tidings of victory against the Al Udeid base in Qatar, using the same number of projectiles that the U.S. had employed in its strike on Iran's nuclear facilities. Although the Islamic Republic did not use its new generation missiles in this attack, the Americans, despite conducting the largest Patriot air defense operation in history, still failed to intercept all of the projectiles. In the end, 6 out of the 14 missiles launched hit their targets. The Al Udeid base in Qatar is considered the most valuable strategic asset of the U.S. military in the region and serves as the headquarters of CENTCOM's Air Command. Alongside the operations True Promise 3 and Glad Tidings of Victory, the network of espionage and sabotage agents inside Iran, which had cost years of investment in training, equipping, and organizing, was being destroyed through vigilance of the people and the efforts of the Basij, security, and law enforcement forces. At the same time, the extraordinary cohesion of Iranians elevated the social capital of Iran to its highest point, and under the guidance of the commander-in-chief, public demands for punishing the aggressor grew stronger. Simultaneously, the measures of state officials to manage affairs and coordinate with the armed forces constantly conveyed to the world the message that Iran, united and in one voice, was ready for a long and powerful defense of its country. It was at this point that the regime had to find a solution for this dire situation. The intensity of the attacks and repeated crossing of red lines, such as targeting places like Evin Prison and medical centers on the 11th day, was for this reason.
Well, the thing you want to remember is that the Israelis depend very heavily on the idea or the notion that they have military superiority over everybody in the region, that they are invincible. And if they start a war and they lose that war, they don't win that war, and indeed it looks like Iran wins the war, this is a significant defeat for Israeli deterrence. It's just something that's almost unthinkable. They started this war thinking that they were going to win a relatively easy victory. And they were going to do to Iran what has been done to Syria. But that's not going to happen. The Iranians are going to stay in this fight. You want to remember that Iran fought against Iraq for 8 years, from 1980 to 1988.
Man, those days we were on Iraq's side, right?
That's correct. So the Iranians, I think, will stay in the fight. And I don't think Israel can maintain this fight over the long term.
Now, the enemies of the Iranian nation were grasping for breath, especially under the weight of global condemnations, which, with the fatwas of great religious authorities, such as Grand Ayatollah Sistani, further tightened the pressure on the U.S. and Zionist regime. If Iran's attacks on occupied territories had continued, if Iranian missiles had targeted other U.S. military bases in the region, if the oil and economic interests of the West had been damaged, if resistance groups in the region, who throughout these 12 days had kept their fingers on the trigger, such as Yemen, had entered the field, and if the energy economy and trade in the Persian Gulf had been disrupted, then what achievement would remain for the supporters of aggression against Iran? It was precisely for this reason that Washington, in a state of panic through intermediaries, proposed an immediate ceasefire to Iran. On June 23, 2025, the second imposed military war against the Islamic Republic of Iran came to an end after 12 days. Although from the very first hours of accepting the ceasefire proposed by the West, the war of narratives began, aiming to portray Israel and the U.S. as victors, awaken consciences, and above all, the people of the region and the Iranian nation knew who the true winner of Iran's struggle against the entire world of domination was.
It has taken Israel's high command just 12 days to see that total victory they claim to have achieved in the first hours of their blitz on Iran turns something that looks much more like a strategic defeat. This 12-day war ended with none of Israel's three war aims being met. Trump's claim that Iran's nuclear enrichment program had been completely and fully obliterated has within a day been flatly contradicted by the intelligence arm of the Pentagon, who sent in the B-2 bombers.
The reason you had a 12-day war was first and foremost because the Israelis were running out of missiles, running out of the means to defend themselves.
Yeah.
Israel was being crushed in one barrage after another of very accurate and devastating missile fire from...
Iran hasn't been defeated. In fact, Iran has punched back very hard against Israel, and Iran still has the ability to intimidate the United States.
Beyond. But no, Israel is not a regional military hegemon and cannot dictate the future shape of the Middle East. The price it has had to pay is high. It has swapped Hamas's homegrown rockets for Iran's ballistic missiles. It has swapped an indirect enemy who uses proxies for a direct one, which has now no hesitation in keeping the entire population of Israel in its bunkers. Netanyahu's lifelong dream of slaying the Iranian dragon may have proved to be a bridge too far.
At the end of these 12 days, Israel not only failed to achieve its initial declared objectives of causing the collapse of Iran's governance, but the military power of Iran, which was supposed to be destroyed, turned into its bane. The U.S. success in destroying Iran's nuclear facilities was also met with serious doubt from experts due to the ambiguous and meaningful silence of the Iranian officials. Thus, the disgraceful and historic memory of the White House's cooperation with the aggression of the Israeli regime was this time etched into history with their failure to achieve their declared goals. Now, the Israeli regime, with its long list of war crimes, such as attacks on ambulances, rescue teams, and medical centers, assaults on scientific and research institutions, assassinations of scientists, intimidation of civilians, and attacks on media centers such as the IRIB and the Central Building of Islamic Radio and Television Union, awaits the consequences of what it has committed. And the U.S., with its lost prestige due to insults and offenses against diplomatic values, stands dishonored with its shattered grandeur at the hands of the Iranians. Meanwhile, along with the sense of pride and the rising spirit of sacrifice among the people, it is the flag of honor and dignity of the Islamic Republic of Iran that has been raised high through the readiness of its sons for struggle across the world, even though in this celebration of victory, we miss many great and small heroes of the homeland.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.